The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I'd been looking forward to Friday all weekend. It was Diane's 14th birthday, and we were going to have a slumber party at her house. Mama offered me a ride, but Diane only lived about half a mile from town, so I walked. Fact was, I liked walking. Gave me a chance to be alone with my imagination. I got to Diane's house about 5 p.m. Casey had already been there a little while. Gail showed up about half an hour after I did. Diane's parents had planned on going to dinner and a movie, so we were going to be left to our own devices for a while. Not that we couldn't be trusted, I mean, we were pretty good girls as a rule, but we all knew that we had it in us to be bad. Whether we'd do anything our parents wouldn't approve of was yet to be seen, but personally, I liked the idea that we might. If we were going to do anything that might get us in trouble, though it was probably going to be something initiated by Casey, she had always been the instigator in our little group, the brave one. The one who would step across the line first and then coax us over. In fact, she had said that she was going to try to steal a bottle of vodka from her stepbrother's stash and bring it over for us to drink. Once Diane's parents had gone for the evening, though, Casey announced that the son of a bitch had drunk it all himself. There hadn't been anything for her to take. Frankly, I was relieved, but like everybody else, I acted disappointed. After Casey finished insulting her stepfather, though, she got that devious look on her face. The one that let us know there was something going on in that wicked little brain of hers. I asked her what she was thinking. She grinned and said, "Maybe I've got something better than vodka." "What could be better than vodka?" Gail asked, trying to sound tough. She was the most timid of our little foursome. "This," Casey said. Then she reached in her backpack and pulled out a book. It was an old-looking book, too. Very old. The cover was dark and dirty, and its edges were frayed. The title was hard to read, but I finally made it out. It said, "Incantations and Their Defenses." We all looked between Casey and the book, and Casey was looking between the three of us, still wearing that devious grin. "A book?" Gail queried. "Really?" "I'm sorry," Diane said, "but are you really planning on reading us a ghost story or something?" Gail added, "Don't you think we're a little old for ghost stories?" "I don't think you're ever too old for ghost stories," Casey said with that familiar edge in her voice. "But this isn't a storybook." "What is it, then?" Diane asked. "It's got spells in it," Casey replied. "Spells and incantations." "You mean like witchcraft?" Diane asked. Casey sort of shrugged, as if not wanting to be bothered with labels. I don't think it's a very good idea," Gail said. "I mean, that's devil worship kind of stuff." "Good Lord, Gail," Casey said. "Get a hold of yourself before you faint or something. It's just a book. But it's from 1791. 1791? I asked. Casey opened it to the title page and showed me. Sure enough, it had been published in New York City in 1791. "Where'd you get this?" "My stepfather's library." You stole it? Gale asked. Borrowed is the word I believe you're looking for, Casey said. As a retribution for the old bastard drinking up all his vodka. We all laughed a little, but then Gale asked, Well, what do you mean to do with it? Not me, Casey replied. Us. Okay then, Diane said. What are we gonna do with it? I thought you'd never ask, Casey said. Then she turned on Diane's bedside lamp to fight off the gathering darkness. I took the liberty to go through it ahead of time, just to see if there was anything interesting. We all waited, and finally I prompted her. And? And I found this here, Casey said, then opened the book to a marked page and laid it on the bed. We all gathered around so we could see. The thing that struck me the most was the smell coming from the book. It was dank and moldy. It smelled of something very old I didn't want to be bothered. Like Granny's storm cellar used to smell when we'd sneak off in it. What's this? Diane asked. The title at the top of the page read Summons of Corson, and it was followed by what appeared to be a list of instructions, all written in a very legible hand. Who is Corson? Gale asked. Not who, so much as what, Casey replied, her grin returning. Corson is a demon, apparently. I knew it, Gale said, sounding more than a little scared. It's devil worship. Calm yourself, Gale, Casey teased. You're not the Virgin Mary. And besides, it's not devil worship. It's a demon. I don't like demons much neither, Casey rolled her eyes. Corson is one of the four kings that have power over the 72 demons constrained by King Solomon, Diane said, reading from her phone. And it says he's not to be conjured except on great occasions. This is a great occasion, Casey said to Diane. It's your birthday. I'm not worried about who or what Corson is, I said. I'm more worried about this book. As old as it is, it's probably pretty valuable. I don't think it's a very good idea for us to have it here. What if something happens to it? I don't want to be responsible. Of course, that led us into an all-out debate about the merits of us having the book, which Casey quickly turned into a referendum on our bravery. And sure enough, just like always, before long she had convinced us that we were just being silly, and that we were obligated to see things her way. It was all nonsense anyway. There was no reason at all for us to not go through the motions of summoning up Corson, just for fun, of course. And also, just like always, Gale didn't so much agree as she found herself overwhelmed by the momentum of the group. The book directed us to sit around a lit candle and to pour a line of salt around us for our own protection. Diane went and got the salt from the kitchen and drew a large circle on her bedroom floor. Casey took a large candle from Diane's dresser, one that was about a foot in diameter and had three separate wicks, and set it in the middle of the circle. We all took our places in the circle, and I lit the candle. All three wicks. I don't think it's a good idea, Gale half whined. But really, guys, let's not do this. By then, our motivation was probably mostly about scaring Gale. It was clear she was very uncomfortable with what was going on. I'm not sure why we found it so entertaining to make her uncomfortable, but we did. I admit that I wasn't very nice, but that's how it was. Casey set the book next to the candle so we could all see it. And then she took the first step as listed in the instructions. She called upon Satan to hear our plea. The lamp on Diane's nightstand sort of flickered. Just a little, but it got our attention. That's enough, Gale demanded. This is foolish. We're just asking for trouble. The book says we all have to be engaged, Casey scolded. Stop your whining and concentrate. Diane sort of laughed, but I couldn't tell for sure if she was making fun of Gale or if she was trying to convince herself that she was okay. As for me, I watched the lamp. Fortunately, or perhaps unfortunately, it stayed steady. "We have to all read the incantation," Gale said, looking mostly at Gale. "Or it won't work." Gale said, "I don't want it to work." "I swear, Gale," Casey scolded. "You have to be the biggest baby I know. I don't hear anyone else complaining." Gale looked down at her lap and sort of fussed with her fingers. She looked so small all of a sudden. There in the flickering candlelight, trying to be brave but not succeeding. Just then, a low growl came from Diane's bedroom door. I won't lie, it scared the shit out of me. I whirled around and was more than a little relieved to find Diane's dog, Buster, standing in the doorway. We were all relieved, I could tell. "It's just a dog," Casey hissed. "Are we going to do this or not?" The breeze had picked up and was blowing through Diane's open window and licking all the flames on the candle. A little voice in my head said to tell Casey that no, we weren't going to do this. It was foolish, and she was starting to sound a little too enthusiastic about it for me to feel comfortable with. I didn't say that, though. Neither did Gale or Diane. We all just sat there, as though Casey truly did have some sort of power over us. I saw a tear trace down Gale's cheek. This was wrong. We should have quit it right then, but we didn't. "Like I was saying," Casey finally said, "we all have to read the incantation 3 times. She looked around the circle at each of us as if to drive the point home, and then she looked back to the book and started to read. Like the lemmings we apparently were, we read right along with her. "Fire est bon an en wamb, di drustum morum biforen com, an brist ocolen seperta faren, lot corson arebi farestin beren." We all read slowly, phonetically, and after the first time, though, the wind picked up and blew out one of the wicks. We kept going, though, faster than the first time, like a rock starting to gather speed rolling down a hill. After the second time, though, the lamp flickered again, and then went out. I don't know why we didn't stop then, why I didn't get out of the circle, but I kept on reading with everybody else. The third time, though, we had sort of found a rhythm, like a chant, and I could feel tingling all over my back as we spoke the words, like tiny fingers were moving across my skin in waves. No sooner than we'd finished reading, the wind stopped blowing altogether. Everything became still and quiet. Buster, who'd been standing in Diane's bedroom door this entire time, let out with a little whimper and scampered away. I could hear his paws clacking as he descended the staircase to the first floor. I didn't feel right. This situation didn't feel right. I couldn't have said what it was, but something was wrong. Something was really wrong. Just then, Buster started barking wildly, like maybe there was an intruder in the house or something. Then I thought I heard another little whimper, and Buster stopped barking. By then, I was so scared I could hardly breathe. I didn't know what to do. "You bunch of babies," Casey said, and then she stood up. "Where are you going?" Gale blurted out. "You can't leave the circle. You'll destroy the protection." "What protection?" Casey laughed. "It's a circle of salt." No sooner than she'd stepped across the line, Diane's bedroom door slammed shut with such force, I thought the hinges would break. All of us screamed. At least I think we all did. Maybe it was just me and Gale. But regardless, after she'd composed herself, and over Gale's protests, Casey started for the door. She said, "I told Tommy to come over if he could." Tommy was her boyfriend, her 16-year-old boyfriend. "It's probably just him and his friends messing with us."
No, don't go,"
Gail protested, but it was too late. Casey opened the door and headed out of our sight. I looked at the other two, still sitting there in the circle of salt with me, and it was plain that they were every bit as scared as I was. Then there came a low, malevolent-sounding growl from the first floor. It wasn't loud, but we could all hear it, and it filled me to the top with fear. Not 2 seconds later, Casey reappeared in Diane's doorway, and she was white as a sheet. I don't think I'd ever seen such a look of terror on somebody's face, not even in a movie.
I'm so sorry," Casey managed to choke out through her fear. I had no idea."
Right then there came a heavy footstep on the stairs, then another, and then another. Casey looked over her shoulder, tears forming in her eyes. And then, without saying another word, she sprinted across Diane's bedroom floor and went out the open window onto the roof of the front porch. She bounded across it, and without even hesitating, leapt from the roof to the ground. The footsteps from the staircase stopped, and then seemed to reverse course. We could hear them echo from downstairs, as though passing through the den. And then we heard the front door squeak open. I wanted to get up and look out the window, to discover what it was that had just apparently let itself out of the house, but fear had a grip on me. I couldn't make myself move. I didn't want to leave the circle.
"What are we gonna do?"
Gail whispered, laced with tears and fear. I only managed to shake my head slowly, and then she began reciting the Lord's Prayer, rocking back and forth as she spoke the words. I looked at Diane. She seemed as dumbfounded and as uncertain as I was about what to do. "In the name of God," I kept thinking. What had we done? What had our silliness unleashed? It wasn't long, probably less than a minute after we'd heard the front door open. There came another sound wafting through the window. It was almost like a scream, but maybe mixed with laughter somehow. How odd. Had it been laughter, though, or something else? I couldn't tell for sure, but whatever it was, it didn't last long. Like Buster's barking, it just stopped. Like somebody had pushed a button and turned it off. "Call somebody," I said to Diane. She was the only one of the three of us who had a phone. "Call somebody. Call 911. She sort of froze and then looked towards her nightstand. "You left it over there?" I asked, exacerbated that she would do something so foolish. But then, of course, I realized it hadn't been foolish at all. I mean, it wasn't as though a reasonable mind would have concluded that a little interaction would work. Regardless, it was clear that she wasn't inclined to leave the circle, so I forced myself to do it. I grabbed the phone off the table and hurried back to my spot by the candle. "Here," I said, thrusting the phone towards her. She took it from me, and after looking at it for a few seconds, pressed at the screen. She looked back at me, fresh fear on her face. "What's wrong?" I asked.
The battery. It's dead."
Of course it would be dead, wouldn't it? "Where's your charger?"
"Downstairs."
No sooner than she'd spoken the word, we heard it. The heavy footsteps on the porch, then in the den, and finally to the staircase. My heart was racing so fast I could no longer feel the individual heartbeats. It was more like a constant hum in my chest. It didn't take long for the footsteps to reach the top of the stairs. Then they started down the hall, towards Diane's bedroom. Our eyes were all glued to the doorway. Our collective terror escalated with each new footfall. We were unable to move, just as we were unable to believe what appeared to be happening. I became aware that Gail had latched herself to my arm, squeezing so hard that it hurt. But I didn't care. All I cared about was whatever was walking down the hall towards us, and why we couldn't seem to move. It felt like it went on forever, the heavy footsteps moving even closer. There wasn't much light at all coming from the hall, barely enough to detect. There was enough, however, for us to see it as it entered the doorway. Or rather, for us to see its outline. It was like a shadow, all dark, and its form largely filled the space from side to side and top to bottom. All of a sudden, a wave of stench wafted over us, so putrid I almost gagged. It smelled like rotted meat packed with maggots, like old and insistent decay, like my granny's storm cellar, only 1,000 times worse. Gail had started praying again. I tried to remove my arm from her grasp, maybe because I thought I needed it to defend myself or something, but she wasn't inclined to let me have it. We heard the low growl again, and the stench in the room got worse. All of a sudden, Diane bolted up and into the bathroom, a Jack and Jill bathroom leading to another bedroom, and the entity disappeared from the doorway. Before I'd even managed to wrap my arms around what Diane had done, Gail shot up as well and headed for the door the entity had just vacated, probably because I was thoroughly petrified and had lost the ability to think clearly. I followed after Gail. It was almost too dark to see, but I heard Gail head down the stairs. I chased after her. I thought I saw Buster lying on the floor over by the fireplace, but I didn't even consider stopping to check on him. Gail flew out the front door, screaming and crying by then, and I kept following after her. She leapt over the porch steps all the way to the ground and kept running. I tried to do the same, but managed to trip when I landed and crash hard into the ground. I could still hear Gail screaming as she ran away from me, farther and farther away as I struggled to my feet, only to discover I'd sprained my ankle. The pain was excruciating, and I fell right back down. And then I heard another scream, but it wasn't coming from Gail. It was coming from inside the house, from Diane. It was shrill and sharp. Then there was a choking sound. And then there was quiet. Oh my God. I scrambled back to my feet and started to limp along best I could, chasing after Gail, but she was already gone. Not only could I no longer hear her, but I couldn't see her anymore either. She had disappeared into the darkness, and I knew that I wouldn't be able to find her. I knew that I was alone, and I knew that whatever that thing in the house was, it was coming. I couldn't move fast enough to escape. I knew that too, so I made a sharp left and headed into the woods. Just then, I heard something walk out onto the front porch, something heavy sounding. So I dove down into a little stand of bushes and tried to be as quiet as I possibly could. I was terrified. It was like everything I'd always known about the world had gotten turned on its head. Monsters were real, weren't they? It wasn't like I'd come to believe at all that they were just stories people made up to scare each other. They were real. Whatever was on the porch began to look my way. At least it seemed like it did to me. I just closed my eyes and tried to lie perfectly still. I was praying inside my head, but I didn't make a sound. Just then I heard a car turn into the driveway, its headlights flooding the yard and then the front porch. To my shock, to my amazed relief, I saw that the thing on the front porch, the thing I'd been so terrified of, was in fact Diane. Seemingly in a daze, she found her way down the front steps and waited as the car pulled up right in front of her. It was her parents, home from the movies. Thank God. I scrambled out from underneath the bushes and limped my way to the front of the car, to where Diane's parents were examining her. I was still frightened out of my wits, mind you, thinking that there was a demon named Corson somewhere in the house and that we were all in mortal danger. But there was something about being in the presence of grown-ups that always made things better. They could handle it. They could fix it. It took me a moment to see why Diane's parents seemed so concerned, though. Why they kept looking at her and asking her questions. Diane's neck was bruised all the way around, reddish and turning blue. It was like someone had choked her hard, like they'd meant to do her real harm. I shuddered to think what had gone on in the house once me and Gail had run out the front door. Things got a little sketchy for me from there. As far as Diane's parents were concerned, Casey was missing, Gail was missing. I'd been hiding in the woods, and Diane looked as if she'd been choked half to death. The police came, and that's when they found Buster. He was lying by the fireplace where I'd seen him, and he was dead. They ultimately decided that he'd stumbled down the stairs and broke his back. Of course, that didn't explain how he'd gotten all the way across the room from the base of the stairs to the fireplace. But I guess they had bigger fish to fry. The police found Casey. She was lying in a drainage ditch out by the road, unconscious and badly bruised. They speculated that she might have gotten hit by a passing car, maybe by someone who hadn't even known they'd hit her, because they never did find the culprit. Fortunately, though, her injuries weren't life-threatening, but she did have to stay in the hospital for a while. They didn't find Gail until early the next morning. She was sitting in the front pew of the Catholic Church, naked as a jaybird. After a number of interviews by people in the psychology world, they determined she was badly traumatized, to the point of having broken from reality just a little. Her family decided to send her to a convent to convalesce. I didn't understand that at all, but it wasn't for me to say. My dad is an atheist, so I pretty much know how he was going to react to all of this. If he didn't believe in God, it was unlikely he believed in demons. He was concerned, though, just like everybody else. I do think he thought there might have been a reason other than my imagination I told him the story I told. I'm pretty sure all the grown-ups believed we'd gotten hold of some bad dope, but I know that's to be untrue. Because of Diane's and Casey's injuries, though, they drug-tested all of us. As it turns out, Diane and Casey had been smoking pot before me and Gail showed up that evening. I'm pretty sure that hadn't had anything to do with what had gone on, but in the end it made us all sound less than credible. So, because they found drugs in her system, nobody really believed what Casey had said about the events of that evening. As for Diane, she conveniently developed a case of amnesia. Couldn't remember a thing from the time Casey had gotten there until her parents came home and found her on the porch. I don't believe her, though. I think she remembers everything, just like I do. For whatever reason, she just doesn't want to face it. I guess I can understand that, but as for me, I can't forget. I know in my heart that something abnormal went on that night, and it scares me to death to think that it could happen again. I had to talk to the police a lot. I must have talked to them a dozen times in the weeks after, and I almost told them the exact same story. I knew I always told them the same story because I always told them the truth. Curiously, though, they never found the book. We had all told them about it, but they never found it, or at least not that they admitted to. It could have been that one of them was a less-than-honest book aficionado, and he decided to add it to his collection. I don't really care. As long as I never have to see it again, that's fine with me. Finally, though, the police stopped coming around, and things started moving back towards normal. But they never would be the same, would they? I mean, how could they? My therapist doesn't think it's strange for me to believe the story I keep telling, but just like the police, she doesn't know what she's talking about. I'd seen what I'd seen, and I'd heard what I'd heard. Maybe we'd been a part of something we weren't intended to. Maybe that's why the book disappeared. Obviously, there are things in this world beyond my ability to understand. All I know for sure is that I'll never go out to Diane's house again, and for the foreseeable future, I'll be sleeping with the light on. My brother, Colin, and I always got along. Sure, we occasionally had fights like most siblings do, but When it came to what we enjoyed, we had a fair amount in common. However, it wasn't until our father took us to a popular caving spot in our town that we realized our favorite thing to do was to go spelunking. Even as the years went on and hobbies came and went, there was just something about the exhilaration of exploring caves that just made us love it more as the years went on. The two of us loved it so much, in fact, that when we were adults, we got side jobs giving tours at a local cave. Once we were finished up for the day, we dropped off our equipment and went for a walk in the forest, sharing stories and having a laugh. We didn't see each other too often throughout the year due to our boring office jobs, so getting to do this was a great way to catch up. However, although we knew the woods well enough, we weren't cocky. Even people who knew a forest like the back of their hand could get lost if they weren't careful. Because of that, whenever we went out for walks, my brother brought an orange highlighter with him. So if we ever went off the trail, he'd draw thick lines on the trees so we could retrace our steps. It had happened on a Friday, when Colin and I were walking down the trails and chatting. We absentmindedly played catch while we chatted, tossing a ball Colin bought at a gift shop for his kid. It was when he accidentally tossed it too far and I went off the trail to get it that I ended up finding a cave. It was a small open area where the trees briefly parted for a small field of grass. Its entrance almost looked like that of a jagged mouth, the rocks hanging off its roof ending in sharp points like a set of sharp teeth. We were confused as we had never seen a cave in this area before, but figured we probably were just in a spot that happened to look similar, with the only difference being that there was a cave. We tried to peer inside it, but found it was too dark to see anything. After a bit of debating, we eventually decided against exploring it. It was getting late, and neither of us had brought any equipment. It wasn't a good idea to go into an unknown cave without the proper supplies, especially when it was almost night, so we decided to head home. To make remembering the spot easier, however, Colin took out his highlighter and marked a couple of extra trees so we would be able to get back to the spot without much hassle. We met up the next day in the morning, this time with proper equipment. I wasn't too fond of walking all the way back to the cave. Now that a bunch of gear and a backpack my spine was getting crumbled under was weighing me down. But I was super excited to check out a new spot. As we reached the first tree with an orange line and began tracing our steps back to the spot, the two of us just couldn't help but ramble about how excited we were. I mean, this was potentially a cave that no one else had gone spelunking in before. For us, two brothers who had been doing this for years, the thought of getting a cave named after us, while probably unlikely, was exciting nonetheless. However, when we finally got through the cluster of trees and into the open space the mouth of the cave rested upon, that eagerness was snuffed out, as well as our happy smiles and joking attitudes. Instead, it was replaced with confusion at what was before us, or rather, what wasn't before us. The entrance was gone, and I don't mean there was a cave-in or anything like that. The entire cave was gone, replaced with nothing more than bundles of dandelions and unusually vibrant green grass. At first, after the confusion cleared away, we tried to be practical about it. Maybe we took a wrong turn, maybe the lines on the trees were from a different trip and just hadn't faded yet, etc. But each reason ended up falling flat. We didn't see any faded markings on the trees when we first went into the trail yesterday, and the ones we used to retrace our steps still looked new, so we couldn't really have taken a wrong turn either. Still, we searched around, looking to see if we were just being stupid. But after hours of walking, exhaustion took its toll on us, and we decided to call it quits. As I told my wife about what had happened over a cup of coffee, she suggested that it was something else we just happened to mistake for a cave. Had we only glanced at it from afar, I probably would have agreed, but we were right up close to the cave's entrance, trying to see if we could make out anything in its darkness. There was no way it wasn't a cave. Cut to a few weeks later in August. Colin and I are still on good terms, and spelunking is still one of our favorite activities. The cave incident, while weird, faded in the back of our minds and became nothing more than something we'd sometimes tell folks during guided tours, occasionally fabricating some stuff about seeing ghosts just for fun. Both Colin and I had an annual thing we did every summer, where, while visiting our hometown, the two of us would head over to the first cave our dad took us to and go on a guided tour in memory of him. We were halfway to the site, gear in hand, when I saw something off the trail and stopped my brother. I went up to it, and my brother followed soon after. Once I got up close enough, I felt a funny feeling in the pit of my stomach when I realized what it was. It was a cave entrance, one I was almost certain I had seen somewhere else. I turned to Colin, seeing that, by his expression, he'd shared the same confusion that I had. This cave looked almost identical to that bizarre cave we saw all those months ago. But that was impossible. Our hometown was an 8-hour drive away from where we saw that cave. There was no way that this was the same one. The idea of checking out the cave came to mind, but at the same time, something felt off. I took a step forward, but my brother stopped me. He wore an odd expression, seeming like he wanted us to check it out, but a part of him was saying no. Eventually, after glancing back and forth at me in the cave a couple times, he'd suggested that he'd go and check it out himself for a couple of minutes, then let me know if it was safe so we could go exploring after our guided tour was done with. Part of me was fine with it, but another part of me was screaming no, that I needed to tell him to get away from the cave, that it wasn't safe. But he ignored it, figuring I was just making something out of nothing. I watched as Colin turned on the light of his helmet, smiling at me and giving me a thumbs up, which I returned, before he turns back to the cave and descended into the darkness. It was at this point that I glanced down at my watch and realized that we had been debating over checking out the cave a lot longer than I thought. We didn't really have enough time to check out the cave before the tour started. For moments, I felt relieved, glad that the things I was worried about, whatever they were, wouldn't come into fruition. I looked up, about to call out to my brother to come back and forget about the cave for now. I never made it past the first word before it was caught in my throat, like a fly in honey. The cave was gone. In the few seconds I had taken my eyes off of it to look at my wrist, it had vanished, replaced with a familiar patch of daisies and vibrant green grass. For a moment, I just froze, like a deer in headlights. I stared at the flowers and grass, my brain trying to process the fact that there was a cave here just a few moments ago. The cave was gone, as was my brother. That's when I panicked. I started calling out to my brother, hoping he was nearby and safe. The quiet callings of my brother's name soon grew in volume, growing louder and louder until I was practically screaming it, praying that he was okay and that this was just a prank, that any second now, he'd sneak up behind me and give me a good fright, and then a good laugh afterwards. When there was no response, my franticness increased. I ran up to the patch of daisies and grass and ripped them out of the ground, putting my ear to the earth and trying to see if I could somehow hear Colin's muffled voice underneath the soil. But there was nothing. It was then I thought I was dreaming. I scrunched my eyes and gave my arm a hard pinch. I opened my eyes, only to be met with the same forest. And that's when I realized I wasn't dreaming. My brother was really gone. In an instant, the cave had vanished and took him with it. As I hurried over to the nearest police station, I debated whether I should mention the cave at all, but I eventually decided against it. I knew I would look crazy, rambling about a cave that vanished and took my brother along with it. So I left it out when I explained what happened. All I told them was that one moment he was with me in the forest, and when I turned around, he was gone. They never found him. The forest was combed, and dogs were sent out to track his scent, but even the dogs seemed unable to find anything, apparently stopping in their tracks and sitting, staring at nothing. I was questioned a bit more, but I never mentioned the cave. It's been a few years now since my brother went missing. I still give tours at the popular caves around our area, and not because I still enjoy spelunking, but because since my wife and I have two children now, we need the extra money more than anything. While I give tours, I bring up my brother to those who would lend an ear to listen. I shared some fun stories about the things we did when we went spelunking as kids, though I didn't bring up his disappearance. It's a small thing, but I find it's the least I can do to help keep the memory of my best friend alive. However, that's not why I'm telling this story. While I miss my brother dearly, that isn't the reason why I'm writing this after all these years. Not the main reason, anyway. I'm telling this story because it's back. A few weeks ago, the cave started reappearing. At first, I thought it was after my kids, but now I think that's not the case. I think it's after me. It doesn't matter whether I'm on a trail in a forest or just outside of it. It doesn't matter whether the forest is small or large, thick or thin. I always see it. No sound comes from its gaping maw, but I find it beckoning me, urging me to find the remnants of the brother I lost all those years ago and uncover the truth. But the scariest part of all is that I almost kind of want to. My name is Clem. I grew up in a little town in South Louisiana called Chicopin, about an hour west of New Orleans and right on the edge of the deep bayou. There were channels everywhere, and you could make it from my backyard all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico by boat. We'd spent time on the water just about every day since I could remember, and we knew the waterways in Terrebonne Parish like the back of our hands. Me and my cousin Rake were about the same age, and we partnered up a lot when we were kids. There were times when we'd spend most of our day on the bayou, hunting and fishing and trapping. That's what life was. For the longest time, that's about all it was. There was one particular day, or night, should I say, that stands out above all the rest, though. A night I still have bad dreams about all these years later. It happened when we were about 12. Me and Drake, and we'd gotten out on the bayou late in the evening to run some traps. Daddy and Uncle Billy pretty much let us go wherever we wanted to because they knew they could trust us. They knew we knew our way around, and they knew we could handle ourselves. We were also supposed to stay inside certain boundaries. To the south, that meant staying out of the ship canals and not portaging over any land barriers that would let us get too far from home. We usually minded those boundaries, but, well, sometimes we didn't. The night I'm talking about was one of those nights when we decided to take some liberties. There were a series of traps we'd set along a part of the bayou we couldn't get into on our little aluminum boats, unless we either skirted along the edge of the ship canals for a ways or else portaged along a small stretch of land. About 100 yards or so, once we'd paddled out to the ship canal and saw that it was clear, we decided to take our chances. The wake from even a smaller ship could swarm us if they passed too close, but we could see far enough both ways to feel comfortable. Besides, portage was always a pain, especially in the dark. We'd made it about halfway to the channel we were headed to when things took a turn. I was in the back of our boat, so I saw it first, a small freighter coming up from behind us. I got Rake's attention and pointed at the ship, and we both knew what to do without further discussion. We dug in deep, paddling as hard as we could. Still, I yelled at Rake to paddle harder as the ship drew near, I could see the edge of the channel we were headed to as the ship's bow pulled up even with us. To tell the truth, I half expected to get wet, but we turned into our little channel just as the ship's wake reached us. We rode on top of the wave for a ways until it died down. Then we laughed and thanked our lucky stars. Semi-disaster avoided. It was a pretty clear night. There was a full moon over us with only the occasional cloud, so we could see well enough to navigate even without our flashlights. There were cypress trees all around, and the Spanish moss hung thick all around, giving the trees a ghostly air. I loved that about the bayou. It always gave me a sense that I was a part of something that wasn't quite squared away. The first trap we came to didn't have nothing, so we moved on towards the next one. It was around a bend and on a little peninsula that was just barely higher than the water. As we paddled nearer and Rake shined the light, we both saw it. Two bright eyes shining back at us. And from the look of them, they belonged to something large. You could always feel your heart rate get up when you caught something, especially if it was bigger than a coon or a possum. I could tell this was bigger. We were eager to get there, but because we were seasoned trappers, we knew to take our time. Steady strokes, do nothing to get the animal more excited or scared than it already was. We must have still been about 40 or so feet away when Rake stopped paddling, though. I stopped too, and we kept drifting slowly towards the bank. I shined my light at the trap, and finally saw what he'd already seen. It wasn't a normal animal there on the bank, at least not one we'd expect to catch. It was a gator, but not just any gator. Maybe the biggest gator I'd ever seen. It had to have been 16 to 18 feet long and 1,500 pounds, if it was a pound at all. It also wasn't caught in our trap. It was just sitting there on the bank, looking right at us, sort of grinning, like it was inviting us on up. Come on, boys, I've got room. Rake had done the right thing by not making any sudden moves, but my body didn't seem inclined to follow suit. I began paddling backwards as hard as I could, and in no time flat I'd stopped our forward progress and started us back in the way we had come. By then there was no point in Rake staying still, so he started paddling as well. He turned us around so our bow was in front, and we stayed at it. By then, though, the gator had slithered into the water and disappeared beneath the surface. Talk about your heart rate going up. My heart was rattling in my chest like that playing card I'd stuck in my bicycle spokes. Even though it wasn't common for a gator to chase after a boat, we kept going until my arms burned like they were about to fall off, and then we both stopped paddling and looked behind us. Rake stood up in the front of the boat so we could shine his light at the water back towards the peninsula without me blocking it. I saw several water moccasins swimming towards the light as they were prone to do, but I didn't see no gator. It occurred to me, though, that the light was as likely to attract a gator as it was a snake, so I yelled at Rake to put out the light. He did, but it was too late. Just as he switched it off, I saw it rise up. The top side of the gator's massive head not more than 5 feet behind us. His big eyes focused right on us. I could see the water rippling too, way back behind where his tail was swimming slowly. Good Lord, he was big. Rake saw him too, but I yelled at him anyway. I was already paddling before his butt hit the seat, and we both started digging at the water as hard as we could. It wasn't but a few seconds later, though, that something bumped up against us on the side, so hard it almost tipped us over. Rake lost his paddle, and it went in the water. I didn't care. Once the boat had settled, I kept on paddling. We had a .22 caliber rifle and a .22 caliber pistol in the boat with us. I didn't figure either of them would do a bit of good against that gator's hide. But since Rake had lost his paddle, he grabbed up the pistol. The gator pushed up against the side of our boat again, but not as solid as before. It didn't cause me to break stride. There was another bump. Then a while later, it felt like the gator tried to come up from under the boat. It sort of lifted us up on the water, and then it went away. I paddled for about as long as I could, and then I stopped. I could see the ship canal from where I was. I told Rake that I didn't think it was wise for us to go out in the ship canal, especially since we didn't have but one paddle. Of course, we could come across something unpleasant on land if we chose to portage, but as long as we had our guns, we should be able to manage. So that's what we decided to do. In any event, we didn't need to sit where we were for very long. That gator could have gotten bored and moved on, but we couldn't be sure of that. We needed to move. Rake shined his light over to the left bank, and pretty sure he found the spot we usually used as a landing. I started moving us in that direction, but no sooner than I got us turned that way, Rake yelled at me to look out, and then fired several shots right past my shoulder. I turned just in time to see the huge gator coming at me, his whole head out of the water with his jaws wide, and just about to come over the stern. I remember thinking in that split second how big his teeth were. They were huge. Anyway, I launched myself forward towards Rake just as the animal landed its head where I'd been sitting. And all at once, the boat pitched up hard and rolled. Me and Rake landed in the bayou. The water was still deep enough to be over our heads this close to the ship channel. And I was disoriented at first, having gone under in all that blackness. Of course, it didn't help that I was completely panicked. But soon enough, I remembered to stay still and look for light. I saw some pretty quick. Moonbeams on the surface. And I swam up to the top. The boat was upside down, but it was just a few feet away from me. I got hold of it about the same time Rake did. I sure was glad to see him there. But I was just as aware that we were truly in mortal danger and had to get going. Rake said it too, that we had to get to land, we had to get to the bank. I said we should stay with the boat, and we did. Him on one side and me on the other, paddling towards the shore. We had just reached the point where our feet could touch the bottom when I felt something brush up against my leg, something heavy and rough. No doubt it was the gator, and its body scraped on by my thigh all the way from its front leg to its back leg. I was so scared it felt like my soul was about to shoot out of my body, and I couldn't help but freeze. I stood perfectly still. Rake asked me what was wrong, but before I could answer, the gator took hold of him and yanked him under. I know I screamed. I know it's not manly at all, but I screamed. I called his name over and over, but I couldn't see him anywhere. Him or the gator, for that matter. No sign at all. I wasn't really thinking clearly by then either, but I managed to turn the boat back over and climb in. As fate would have it, the only thing left in our boat was my paddle. No guns, no flashlights, no nothing but my paddle. Yet I got jammed up under my seat somehow when the gator had come crashing down on it. Needless to say, maybe, but by then I'd become hysterical. I mean, it didn't seem real. How was it possible that my cousin was out there somewhere under the water in the jaws of a huge gator? It was too awful to consider, yet that seems to be the story. That was what there was. That was all there was. And gators didn't eat you right away, neither. They took you under in a death roll until you were drowned. Then they stuffed you under a ledge or log or something and left you there to rot. But once you were ready, they'd come back for you and eat you piece by piece. For all the world and everything in it, how could that be my cousin Rake's destiny? To rot under a log and then be ate up by a huge gator. There was nothing, though. No sound but the occasional hoot of an owl and the croak of a bullfrog. And I thought I heard a big cat growl, but other than that, the bayou was quiet. Then, all of a sudden, not far from me, there came a big splash and a fuss across the surface of the water. I saw Rake. He was trying to swim away from the gator, but the gator was practically on top of him. And only a second or so later,
they both went back under. This was horrible. The most horrible thing I could imagine, and I was living it. I paddled over to where they'd gone down, but there was nothing to be seen. A few seconds later, though, they came back up, more out towards the middle. I yelled out his name. He managed to look my way for a split second, and he yelled my name. But then the gator took him under again. I didn't know how I knew, but it was clear to me right then and there that hearing him call my name like that, and seeing the gator take him under, would haunt me for the rest of my life. I started towards where they'd been, but then they came up again, more towards the bank. This time, not only did he call my name, but he also screamed the word, help. And screamed it he had, like nothing I'd ever seen. The sound of his voice was the embodiment of terror, and hearing it made my skin crawl all over. Then, like before, they disappeared beneath the water, and the last thing I saw was Rake's hand clawing at air, trying to find anything to grab a hold of. I desperately paddled towards them again, and I started looking, hollering for them, bending over the side of the boat so far, trying to see under the water that I almost fell out. Too long. He'd been under too long this time. There was no way he could still be alive. I came to know that in my heart, in a feeling of evil and darkness like I'd never even imagined possible, began to settle over me. This was more than I could bear. I didn't see how I could find my way back to any form of sanity. I could feel it in my whole body, like a weight, like a prison, and I could barely breathe. Suddenly, and without any warning at all, something came crashing through the surface of the water right beside my boat, like it had been shot out of a cannon. Miracle of miracles. It was Rake. And he was most of the way in the boat before I could even get over and help drag him the rest of the way in. He flopped in on the boat's bottom like a big fish, and before I could fully grasp the reality of what had just happened, he was screaming at me to paddle, to get to land. He wouldn't shut up about it. And finally, I made my way to my seat and started paddling for shore. Rake was breathing hard and moaning just about every other breath. But I couldn't tend to him just then. I had to get us to shore. I was afraid to look over my shoulder to see if we were being followed, but finally I couldn't help it. Sure enough, there it was. That big gator was right behind us, no more than 3 feet back, just skimming along with nothing showing but the top of its head and back, with its tail swishing back and forth real slow. Just a second later, I ran the boat aground and hopped over Rake and out the front so I could drag it all the way up. Once I'd done it, I looked out over the water, fully expecting to see the gator coming up after us. But to my surprise, I didn't see him anywhere. I didn't quite trust it. I mean, it could have popped out of the water at any moment. But the relief I felt in that instant was indescribable. Anyway, whether the gator was coming after us or not, I had to get farther from the water, so I dragged the boat a good 20 yards inland. Only then did I dare give Rake a good look, and what I saw was ghoulish. He had blood on him in lots of places, but the thing that got to me the most was his leg, his right leg. From the knee all the way down to his foot, there was nothing but bone. No skin, no meat. Just bone. The little bone in back was just hanging loose, and I could see where the big bone was almost broken, too. The thing that I found so odd, though, was that his shoe was still on his foot. His leg had gone through all of that, and somehow his shoe had managed to stay on his foot. Anyway, I tried to talk to him, but he wasn't making any sense. I could see that his leg was bleeding bad from just below his knee, and I knew that he was bound to bleed to death if I couldn't find a way to stop it, or at least slow it down. Frankly, I don't know how I managed the presence of mind, but somehow, right then, I knew what I had to do. I took off my belt and wrapped it around his thigh right above the knee, and pulled it tight as I could, and then I wrapped it around again and tied it off.
I could see the bleeding slow down, seemed like by a lot. No sooner than I got the belt cinched in place, though, I heard the low growl of a big cat, maybe the one I'd heard when I'd still been out on the water, somewhere real close. Maybe it had been watching, stalking us, waiting to see if we'd managed to escape the gator and make it to dry land. By then, no doubt, smelling all that blood was whetting its appetite. I had to admit my imagination was in fear-fueled overdrive, but there wasn't a doubt in my mind that there was a panther nearby, and that it was going to come for us. I couldn't just sit there and wait for it to attack, though, so I hopped over the boat and started dragging it, which wasn't that easy by myself in the dark with a rake lying up towards the front of it. I almost tripped several times over roots and such, but I managed to keep my balance and to keep going. I could hear it, though. I could hear the big cat pacing us, probably waiting for the right moment. I stopped to listen, and it stopped. I started back up, and it came along. It was crazy. I felt completely vulnerable, yet I was unable to do anything about it. If only our guns weren't at the bottom of the bayou. I'd made it about 3/4 of the way across, and I had to stop the rest, just for a minute. But I had to stop. That's when it happened. The panther came at me in a flash and knocked me back into the boat. I came down on top of Rake, and the panther came down on top of me. I knew in my heart that we'd come to the end, because there was a full-grown cat on me, and I was still just a boy, all alone without any means to protect myself. The moment was near. I could feel it. Just when my will to live was about to succumb to the panther's desire to eat, though, I heard it. It was a shot, coming from very near, and in that instant the big cat went limp and fell lifeless upon me. I scrambled over from under it and managed to find my feet in a hurry. What a strange memory. The sight of seeing Rake and that panther lying side by side in the bottom of that boat, one barely alive, the other dead as a stone. It all seemed like a dream, even then, but I knew it wasn't. Just then I felt a hand on my shoulder. It was my daddy. I could say with complete confidence that I'd never been so glad to see somebody in all my life, before or since. Him and Uncle Billy and two of their friends had come looking for us when we hadn't made it back for supper, and luckily for us, they had. I told them what had happened real quick, and just as quick, Daddy and Uncle Billy carried us to their boat and took us back to the house so they could get Rake to the hospital. Their friends stayed back. They had a gator to hunt and kill. Rake lost his leg below the knee, but he kept his life. I still don't understand how he managed to get away from that big gator, but he had. I can't even imagine what those few minutes must have been like for him, fighting against that beast under the dark water. Unlike me and the panther, I've always thought that maybe his will to live had been stronger than the gator's desire to eat. Maybe that's true, and maybe it's not. All I know for sure is that all these years later, I still travel all over those bayou channels, and so does Rake. And just like when we were kids, sometimes we follow the rules, and sometimes we don't.